We're in Seattle at Sleep 2009 with Charles Seisler, who's a prominent sleep researcher at Harvard's Brigham and Women's Hospital. Chuck, it amazes me that here we are in sleep research, and I'm still looking at a cover of a magazine, current magazine, that is asking the question, why sleep? I mean, is the field still in such disarray that we don't know what we're doing? I mean, what's your sense of the state of the science at this point of sleep?
Well, we all know why we breathe. We all know why we need to eat. But at a basic level, the general society doesn't really understand why we need to sleep. And in fact, many people spend much of their time trying to figure out how to cut as much sleep out, because sleep is viewed as sort of a reserve time. And if you don't have enough time for whatever reason to get what you feel that you want to get done or the fun that you want to have, the first thing to go is sleep. And that's essentially because it's not recognized by most people that, just like exercise and nutrition, sleep is one of the three pillars of good health. And part of the reason for that is that people fundamentally don't know why we sleep. And there's been a tremendous amount of effort to try to figure out one function of sleep. And the data that are emerging speak volumes to the fact that sleep doesn't simply serve one function, but serves many functions. And that the immune system, metabolism, brain function, cardiovascular health, all are related to getting a sound and consolidated amount of sleep at night. And that when sleep is degraded, each of those functions is impaired. Most people find it shocking that if they're getting an inadequate amount of sleep, when they get a flu shot, they only have half the antibody response that they would if they had been getting an adequate amount of sleep. Many people find it shocking that if they are getting an inadequate amount of sleep, that their incident rate of calcification of the coronary arteries is much higher after 5 years if they're sleeping an inadequate amount each night as compared to if they're getting an adequate amount of sleep. Because we don't think of the body being affected by sleep. And many people are shocked to learn that it's the sleep that they get after training on a task, or after hearing a lecture, or after learning something during the day, that is critical for the consolidation of memory. And that it's not just a matter of being able to stay awake to hear something that determines whether the importance of sleep in that function.
I've got two questions. One is the about controversies here, because I've talked to a number of people, and when you say an adequate amount of sleep, it's not clear to me that everybody agrees on that at all.
That's another good point.
It's some people would say that, you know, obviously there's a range. Some people seem to do perfectly well on 5-6 hours. Others, what seems to be consistent is that extremely long sleep correlates with early death. In fact, it takes years off your life to be sleeping at an extremely long time. So there's that whole area. And then there's this...
Well, short sleep is associated with an increased risk of premature death. The problem with those epidemiologic studies is that it's not clear that the people, for example, sleeping an extremely long time might not have some other comorbidity that is associated with an inability, because we know that when we are ill, we also tend to sleep longer.
So it's a consequence of a pathology rather than a natural...
It may be. I mean, nobody really understands. Yeah. And a number of psychiatric conditions also have changes in the timing of sleeping and waking that could affect mortality. So we really don't know from those large-scale epidemiologic studies. But the interventional studies in which actually individuals have had their sleep curtailed for a period of time show adverse metabolic effects when your sleep is shortened to 4 or 5 hours per night, with increased levels of the hormone ghrelin, which makes people more hungry and crave carbohydrates, and decreased levels of the satiety hormone leptin, that are consistent with the notion that when you are sleep deprived, your ability to metabolize glucose is impaired, and so insulin resistance goes up. And as Professor Ev Van Cowder puts it, you almost go into a pre-diabetic state, where there are impairments in the metabolism of glucose that are predicted to be associated with weight gain and with difficulty in metabolizing glucose. So there are many different fronts that suggest that getting an inadequate amount of sleep has adverse effects both on the body and on the brain. But you've asked the question, what's adequate? And that is a matter of controversy as to how much sleep we need and whether or not sleep need changes with age. I'm reminded of one of my favorite statements that I've ever heard describing this, which was from Tom Roth. He said, while there are inter-individual differences in the amount of sleep that people need, the number of people who need 5 hours of sleep or less, expressed as a percent and rounded to a whole number, is zero. Young, healthy adults need somewhere between 8 and 9 hours of sleep per night, probably averaging about 8.5 hours of actual sleep. Children need somewhere between 9.5 and 11 hours of sleep per night between the ages of, middle school children through high school. And children younger than that need even more sleep than that. So we know that there is a change in the amount of sleep that we need with age. Mm-hmm. We also know that children have lost more sleep as an age cohort than any other group in our society. So between the ages of about 5 and 19 years old, children have been losing about 10 minutes of sleep per year in industrialized countries around the world for the last 20 to 30 years.
Doing what? Getting up earlier so they can travel to school, or staying up later and watching TV, or a combination?
Most of the loss is associated with a delay in the start of bedtime, because oftentimes the wake times are fixed because they have to go to school. And so with each passing year, the children are on average going to bed later, with some children even getting much less sleep than that. So we're doing a very large-scale experiment on our kids. As compared to 40 years ago, they're getting somewhere between 2 to 4 hours per night less sleep during critical phases of their brain development. And I don't think that it's a coincidence, for example, that 10% of 12-year-old boys in the United States are diagnosed as having ADHD. And I think many of the children who are diagnosed as having ADHD may be misdiagnosed because they are in fact sleep deprived. Sleep deprivation in children manifests itself in a way that's different than in adults, because instead of becoming sleepy and putting their heads down on the desks, they become hyperactive and have difficulty focusing their attention, and they become emotionally more labile and more difficult to control. In fact, I remember when I was bringing my daughter a number of years ago to kindergarten for the first time, and the teacher had no idea what any of us did, but she had the parents in to get us ready for bringing our kids for the first time to school. She told the class of assembled parents that the most important thing that you can do to prepare your child for pre-K is to make sure that they get enough sleep. Now, as a sleep researcher, I almost fell over. And I looked around. Does she realize what I do? No, she didn't make any eye contact with me. And she said, I can tell within the first 10 minutes after they get here whether you've kept them up late the night before, because behaviorally, they are so difficult to manage. Mm. And she said, if you keep your children up, don't even bother bringing them to school, because I don't want to handle them during the daytime. And that's how clear it is. And many mothers and fathers will immediately recognize, particularly in young children, 2 or 3 years old, that if they haven't allowed them to get enough sleep, that they become cranky and difficult to deal with the next day. But somehow the parents forget that. And as the children get older, now let's say they're 5, 6, 7 years old, as soon as they begin going to school, many parents are of the mindset that if they're getting the same amount of sleep as the parents, they're doing pretty well. And of course, many of the parents themselves are sleep deprived. They're not getting home till 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. They're not beginning dinner until after the time that the children should be in bed already. And so the kids are not going to bed till 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and they're barely getting 7 or 8 hours of sleep instead of the 9 to 11 hours of sleep that they actually need. And I think that that is contributing to a great deal of what is being diagnosed as hyperactivity.
One of the enormously important aspects of a meeting like this is to try and find out whether the basic research can be applied and conveyed into the schoolroom. In other words, has social and policy implications. I mentioned that we also do a meeting called Brains R Us, which is about the science of educating. My understanding is it's really hard to teach a sleep-deprived brain.
It's very hard to teach a sleep-deprived brain, particularly when that brain doesn't even get sleep the night after the teaching. It's a vicious circle, because a sleep-deprived brain can't pay attention, particularly in children who become so easily distracted and have difficulty focusing their attention if they haven't gotten enough sleep. And then during the time that they would be consolidating the memories that they had during the daytime from school, if their sleep is disrupted or inadequate, they'll also have more difficulty consolidating those memories and laying down those facts and doing the associative thinking that we need to do in order to connect the information that we've learned during the daytime. Not to mention the adverse effects that inadequate sleep has in terms of other bodily functions. There's a recent study showing that if at the age of 2 kids are getting less than 12 hours of sleep per night, they're much more likely to be overweight when they come in to kindergarten for school several years later. Again, the effects of sleep on metabolism are probably responsible for that societal burden of the increased risk of obesity. But then there is then a subsequent effect, because the increased number of people who are overweight, kids, is now making obstructive sleep apnea a problem in children as well as in adults. It used to be that if a child had obstructive sleep apnea, it was almost certainly completely cured by tonsillectomy, because the vast majority of children who had trouble breathing during sleep, it was associated with enlarged tonsils. Now, tonsillectomy is not working, just in the same way as type 2 diabetes, which used to be called adult onset diabetes, is now happening in children. Similarly, obstructive sleep apnea that can only be treated by CPAP is now also happening in children as well, as the waistlines of our kids get bigger. So it becomes a vicious circle. Inadequate sleep leads to changes in metabolism, insulin resistance, which in turn is associated with weight gain, and then obstructive sleep apnea, the disrupted sleep, also further foments the increase in weight. So it's a massive public health problem that at its root, in many instances, I think is related to inadequate sleep.
You can't mandate sleep, however. I mean, what can you do? I mean, if you looked at Mary Kaskaden's work, for example, there was a suggestion there at least that the school should start an hour later. Does that make sense? Is it the sort of policy decision that can emerge from sleep research that should be implemented?
I think there are two aspects. One is that we need to educate the public about the importance of sleep. The Institute of Medicine did a study in 2006 concluded that education about sleep and its disorders is one of the most important priorities that we need to have going forward in order for people to understand the health and safety consequences of sleep loss, sleep disorders, sleep deprivation in general. Because we have an epidemic of sleep disorders in our society, with somewhere between 40 and 70 million people affected by the combination of sleep disorders and chronic sleep deprivation. We have 250,000 people a day falling asleep at the wheel. That's each and every day in the United States.
A day?
250,000 people falling asleep at the wheel.
We
have over 1 million sleep-related accidents on the highways every year. 60,000 debilitating injuries related to drowsy driving and 8,000 deaths annually related to drowsy driving related accidents. So it's a major public health problem. In fact, 1 out of 5 motor vehicle crashes is related to drowsy driving.
What do you say then to the people who would argue that there isn't in fact an optimal amount of sleep, that people vary and so on, and that we shouldn't be trying to impose this sort of sense of being a sleep-deprived society on everybody?
Well, the facts on the drowsy driving crashes belie the notion that we're getting enough sleep as a society. Caffeine is the only addictive substance that we routinely give our children. And we give it to the children in the form of quote-unquote energy drinks. Mm-hmm. And this is a relatively new phenomenon. The energy drinks and energy bars and so on, they, about 2 or 3 years ago, the sales in those drinks being marketed to children went up by 80% to a $3.4 billion industry. And now that industry has come out squarely against legislation that has been introduced in Maine that would require even labeling the amount of caffeine in these items that are being sold to our children. So if you look at they're all labeled in a very cheerful way, you know, sports bar, energy drink, mm-hmm. They're even labeled for the individual sports, you know, do better on the field and so on. What they don't reveal is that their main ingredient is caffeine. You know, they could be selling no-dose tablets and giving it to the kids. And if it said no-dose tablets, the parents would pause before giving it to their kids. And it's similarly with the ADHD drugs. You know, they're given all sorts of wonderful names. One of the most common ones is simply mixed amphetamine salts. Maybe the parents would put 2 and 2 together if they realized the kids are not getting enough sleep. Now they're right. Saying your child is having difficulty focusing attention in school and we're going to try amphetamines. I mean, hello.
So you take this message to the legal system, don't you, basically?
I think that it's important that we begin to address the issue at its core and that we need to have some regulation in terms of work hours in the United States. And one of the biggest problems is the resident physician work hours. It's hard for physicians to try to convince the public that they need to get more sleep when they are scheduling interns and residents to work 30 consecutive hours twice a week. Get your own house in order before you go talking to other people about what they need.
Yeah.
You know, one of my favorite cartoons was that of a patient coming to see a doctor saying, "Doctor, I only managed to get 5 hours of sleep a night. Can you help me?" And then there's a little bubble over the doctor saying, "That's 5 more hours than I got." So it's hard for the doctor to have much empathy or sympathy or understanding for what the problems of chronic sleep restriction are when they're put on such brutal schedules in a framework that's left over from the 1890s, developed by a physician, Professor Halstead at Johns Hopkins, who was a cocaine addict. And he's the one who established these extended duration shifts for physicians that were still working over 100 years later.
We've been talking about this for quite a long time. I remember actually coming to your lab at one point and going with your light box to shift my entrained
circadian rhythms,
something that can help people with jet lag and shifted schedules,
yes.
And so on. Chronobiology and the whole notion of circadian rhythms seems to me a much more mature and cleaner experimental science. We know a lot of the stuff much better. Sleep science, sleep research still seems to me to be somewhat in its infancy, not quite as clean and so on. Is that an unfair characterization, or are we getting there?
I think the field of sleep science and sleep medicine has made extraordinary advances, particularly in the last few years, in which a better understanding of genetic differences that may underlie everything from sensitivity to caffeine to vulnerability when we stay awake at night. And now it's being recognized that there are genetic polymorphisms that may be predictive in helping to understand why one person, when they stay awake all night, seems to be able to do it without much of a problem, and someone else has many more lapses of attention and may be at much greater risk to have, for example, a motor vehicle crash when they stay awake all night.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about these articles I'm looking at. There's Tononi and Chiarelli have their theory about homeostasis and pruning of synaptic connections overnight as a way of kind of resetting the brain's energetic system. Alan Pack has a piece in here, and I think they may have pulled a line out, which says, our research has shown that the act of sleeping has biological functions that supersede the role and control of the circadian clock, as if these are two separate issues. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, our research indicates that what's really most important is an interaction between the sleep-wake regulatory processes and the homeostatic processes that regulate the amount of sleep that we get. And that performance is actually at its absolute worst when we challenge both systems. So when we're at an adverse circadian phase and sleep deprived, there is an interaction that is not just additive, but which is almost multiplicative. So that you now have a nonlinear interaction such that you make many, many more errors and are much, much more vulnerable to the effects of sleep loss when you are at an adverse circadian phase. Mm. On the converse, when you're at a circadian phase at which the output of the internal clock is sending out its strongest drive for waking, then even if you are chronically sleep deprived, you may be able to perform reasonably well. So there is a remarkably powerful interaction between circadian rhythms and sleep deprivation. And that's why, for example, when one goes out into the field and does studies of truckers and other occupations where there's often an element of both sleep deprivation as well as misalignment of circadian phase, mm-hmm. that the really serious increased risk of sleep-related crashes occurs in the latter half of the night when the individuals are both sleep-deprived and at the wrong circadian phase.
So a whole series of palliative measures has to be taken across a number of different areas. There's the public education part of it, obviously. There's the shift systems are punishing.
That's right. That's right. Well, in the medical profession, we know that there is a serious increased risk of error, particularly errors that cause that require the integration of information. Diagnostic mistakes are up more than 400% when individuals work 30 consecutive hours as compared to when they work 16 consecutive hours, even though they, of course, still have to cover the 24-hour day.
You know, there is this sort of this human, certainly younger human, resistance to believe this advice you're being given, isn't it? That it's not until you've actually had the crash and had the DUI that you really think that you weren't capable of driving that car. And it isn't until you've done something bad that you believe somebody when they say, you know, you look really pretty tired.
There is that. And it's sad that in the medical profession, one out of five physicians admits to making a fatigue-related mistake during their internship that has injured a patient, and one out of 20 admit to us that they've made a fatigue-related mistake that has resulted in the death of a patient. Now, when that happens, there are serious adverse psychological consequences in many individuals to recognizing that a mistake that they made, which was a preventable mistake if they had gotten an adequate amount of sleep, has resulted in the death of another human being. And we're not talking about a small number. There are 100,000 interns and residents in the United States. So that means that tens of thousands of people are being injured every year, and thousands are dying every year as a result of fatigue-related mistakes, that are occurring because we have a system that doesn't take into account the basic biology of both the internal biological clock and the sleep homeostat, which conspire to make a critical zone of vulnerability in the latter half of the night when you try to stay awake for 30 consecutive hours. And these kinds of practices that began in the 1890s, we need to move on from that in the 21st century. We can't hold on to a tradition that is endangering people and endangering the physicians themselves, because they, driving home from these marathon shifts, they have 168% increased risk of a motor vehicle crash. And you know, even when they're doing a procedure in the hospital, they have more than a 70% increased risk of stabbing themselves with a needle, which is the biggest occupational risk that they face in hospitals because of the risk of HIV and hepatitis.
I don't think I ever asked you this. How did you actually get to be involved in sleep research specifically?
As an undergraduate, my undergraduate thesis was on the timing of the release of the hormone cortisol, which turns out to have a very prominent circadian rhythm. And when I went to Stanford to continue the research, I was working in Bill DeMint's lab, and Elliot Weitzman, with whom I was working, convinced me to begin to record sleep, and which I did not think was very important, because for that particular hormone, if you stay awake all night, the pattern of its release is similar to what it would be if you slept. And in one of the experiments that we did, we had trouble. And the very first time I tried to record sleep, the instrument wasn't working, and I was dubious about having agreed to add that to our protocol because the technician could not make the machine work and so on. I didn't myself know how to operate it, which was frustrating because it was added in as a collaboration. And but what we learned from that experiment when the results came back was that the 3-hour delay in the timing of the bedtime had had a bigger impact on the hormone that I was studying than any of the other manipulations I had ever done.
Wow.
And so from that point forward, I became interested in the relationship between the timing of the release of hormones and the timing of when we sleep and wake. And then gradually, that led to many other experiments.
I'm glad you stayed in the field then.
Yeah. Yeah, so I came into it by accident.
All right, well, it was wonderful talking to you. Charles Seisler, thanks very much.
Thank you.